Hey guys, this is Katie. I'm a producer for Marketplace. I know you're used to hearing the daily news in this feed, but we've put together a special series that we think you're going to like. There's a lot of talk right now about robots and technology taking jobs away from people, but which jobs and how soon? We'll be trying to answer those questions and more. The series is three parts. The first episode came out on Monday, and now here's part two.
Can I interest you in a big, beefy spider the size of a bicycle wheel that skitters across the floor?
And then the legs, there's a controller that basically figures out, okay, where are the legs now? Where do they need to go to basically keep myself balanced? So I can drive it around, I can go up, I can go down.
Arachnophobes, be not afraid. This is only a hexapod with just six instead of eight legs. And relax, it's a machine, a robot.
Kind of modular building blocks is what we're calling these. We're kind of inspired by Lego. We want to get to the point where people can put these together as easily and intuitively as Lego.
A Pittsburgh company named Hebby Robotics has developed these interchangeable modules that serve as the shoulder, elbow, or knee of any robot you'd care to construct. Just add bits of tube, springs, and footpads, and voila, custom robot, pounding the pavement with its clever little legs. If technology is ascendant in the workforce, then being the person who develops the technology seems like a pretty safe place to be. I'm David Brancaccio, host of the Marketplace Morning Report. This is Robot Proof Jobs, part two of a pop-up podcast series on a force that could be bigger than globalization when it comes to America's prosperity. Machines, algorithms, artificial intelligence, software, robots. We know technology creates jobs, but also fiercely competes for jobs. Automation is coming to the workplace now more than ever. I'm asking, what do we humans do to take advantage of this? In the first episode, I started a road trip through the Midwest to meet people with jobs that, for now, are resistant to encroachments by technology, the folks robots are less likely to usurp. Now, in podcast part two here, I want to spend some time with what may be the career supreme for beating the robots at their own game, a job in the robot business itself. These tech careers are golden, so how is it possible there's such a shortage of humans to fill them? I first met Dave Rawlinson here in Pittsburgh 5 years ago when I was doing an earlier story on robots and jobs. Then he was a graduate student at nearby Carnegie Mellon University's Robotics Institute. He was working then on snake robots for search and rescue and finding flaws in disgusting sewer pipes. 5 years later, Dave has co-founded the company that made this big, crabby robot we're fooling with here. Old-style robots are ungainly and can do damage if they misjudge the location of anything they touch. Hebby is commercializing the modular controllers that serve as the robot's flexible joints.
Really don't control position too carefully, just push down, and when I hit the table, it'll just stop naturally, which is kind of a much more human-like way of interacting with the world. But it's very new to robotics, so people are still trying to figure out how to kind of harness the power of being able to control force in a way that's useful. But we're getting there, and we're kind of on the leading edge of it.
With technology both assisting us on the job and increasingly competing with us for work, one strategy to fend off the robots is to go Dave's route, become the creator of tech, not its competitor. But doing a startup like this takes intestinal fortitude.
You're taking off a plane like while you're building the runway underneath it. It is that kind of level of stress.
Since we first met, a lot's been going on with Dave, originally from the little town of Clifton Forge in southwest Virginia. He's now Dr. Dave, PhD. And while he's been giving birth to this company, he now has a spouse and a little human.
A 1.5-year-old Amos.
Amos, congratulations.
Thank you.
That's wonderful.
He's already better than the world's best robot. It's kind of amazing watching kind of the trajectory they're on and how quickly they learn. So like his ability at a very early age to just like go to a bin and pick out exactly the toy he wants.
And look, I knew it was premature to ask, but I asked it anyway. What is he going to do to help young Amos be ready for the uncertain job market of the future?
Being a lifelong learner is going to be so important. Just the ability to pick up new things quickly, the ability to have the passion to pick up new things quickly. You know, let him be self-directed as much as possible. If he wants to bang on the piano, then we just pop in front of the piano as long as he wants. And if he wants to play with Legos, play with Legos.
When a job that doesn't even exist today could be created and then eliminated by technology all before young Amos even enters the workforce, then education becomes a moving target. There's a mismatch even now. Listen to Dave Rawlinson's biggest worry on the professional front, finding people who have the right skills to work at his company.
You've like whittled your set down to probably like a handful of people in the world that can really do what it is you're trying to do. And there's no way around it being like a slow, detailed process, but it is probably our number one concern as we grow is just finding the right people.
Across town at Dave's alma mater, we pick up this theme. David Bourne is a principal system scientist at CMU's Robotics Institute. He's taken me into one of his labs, a big open bay. It's like that scene in every James Bond movie where you meet Q, the inventor, only it's a graduate student doing the work here today.
Here's Q's assistant, who's actually the real worker. He's Mabaran. He's awesome.
Mabaran Rajaraman is running a prototype robot that can recognize and manipulate big pieces, for instance, girders, on a construction site. Bourne says you can't have more people with robotics jobs if there aren't enough professors of robotics to teach them. Many potential teachers are being swallowed up by industry, like Uber, which famously hired away 4 professors and dozens of robot researchers from here to work on self-driving cars.
Just to give you an example, in one of our programs, we had 600 applications and there were 40 spots. So think about that. That's 560 students, all of which are really qualified. If you look at their applications, you're pretty impressed with the 560 that didn't make it. That should give you a pause. You know, there's a lot of people that can't do the field they want to do.
Across the country, another former student here is doing her part to train the roboticists of the future.
It was just what I was passionate about. I loved math. And I did math competitions on the Math Olympiad. And I was raised in a country where math is like our national sport, right?
Anca Dragan, originally from Romania, is a second student I met 5 years ago. Back in 2012, when she was still doing her graduate work, I teased her a little. Do her parents call worrying if she'll ever find meaningful employment? Well, she's landed on her feet just fine. I'm speaking to her at her office in Berkeley, California, where she's now a UC professor in the Electrical Engineering and Computer Sciences department. Her parents, happy, finally?
They say, why did you not accept the Stanford offer?
But they must have been very proud of you.
They were, yes, absolutely.
Her research now centers on the relationship, call it the tango, between humans and robots, which can also be engineered to communicate their intentions non-verbally.
We can't help but read things into the actions that we see. We're just wired to do that. We ascribe intentions. We ascribe capabilities or the lack of capabilities. We even ascribe some sort of, whether we want to or not, some sort of mental state like, oh, this machine is excited or bored or whatever, right? And I think we need to get machines, robots, to actually be aware of that, to be able to take control over what they're expressing to these people.
I love the story about her early inspiration, a book she discovered in high school.
I got my hands on Stuart Russell and Peter Norvig's book on AI, and I read parts of it, whatever I could understand as a 12th grader.
AI, artificial intelligence, which prompted her to embark on a career of the future, if ever there was one.
Now I get to be a colleague of Stuart's, and he's just a few offices away. So it's really interesting to think of where I was in 12th grade and sort of the luck that I have now.
Well, luck in the sense of you can help make your own luck, but also the luck of being born in a country, Romania, with a culture that prioritizes math and science. Human math ability does tend to thwart the robot competition. My colleague, Marketplace producer Katie Long, has been doing a lot of the hard work on this road trip, and she's the keeper of the jobs and automation data we're using from the McKinsey Global Institute.
Computer and information research scientists. Automation risk, 22%, pretty low. There are 22,000 in the economy. The pay is good, low six figures.
Professor Howie Chosett is another renowned robot researcher at Carnegie Mellon. He's also chief technology officer of something called the ARM Institute, for Advanced Robotics in Manufacturing Institute. This is a national partnership with the feds, academia, and industry, set up to deal with the following stunning piece of news.
We're the world's leader in robotics research. We're the world's leader in so many things, but we're not in industrial robotics. There is no major manufacturer of industrial robots in the United States.
Are you kidding me? Most factory robots are designed and made in foreign countries? I looked it up. The top five list of industrial robot companies goes like this. Japan, Japan, Germany, Japan, Switzerland. There's an American company down at number 10. Chosit and team have gotten serious money to try to turn this around.
With any automation, there's always going to be some displacement. What we have to do is take care of that displacement. Retraining is a fact of life. So we, in the Arm Institute, one of our functions is to provide workforce training experiences for small companies.
The top mission of this institute isn't spreading the good word about robots. It's listed as making U.S. jobs. The penny drops. Chosit's team feels the need to create something that I would compare to a carbon offset. Instead of compensating for greenhouse gases, they want to compensate for jobs that robots might chew up. Technology creates work, but as we've been hearing, it also replaces workers. So this institute is forming a sideline to retrain people for jobs that use robots.
It's just a fact of life. This automation is coming. So we should make the decision right now. Do we want to be the leaders or the laggards?
I'm finding there's a paradox within the paradox here. Right now, there's a shortage of people to do these technical jobs. The Manufacturing Institute in Washington predicts that by the year 2025, there will be 2 million unfilled jobs in the U.S. because there aren't enough workers with the right skills. That is a 2 followed by 6 zeros. 2 million possible jobs unfilled within 8 years. I said this road trip is about what to do about all this automation coming into the workforce. Well, how about this? Retraining in action in Tecumseh, Michigan. I had gotten into a factory that makes structural parts for cars and trucks.
We make the gore or the grill opening reinforcement or something. I think that's what
it's
called.
What's behind the
that's the rugged metal nose hidden behind all the decorative trim on a car or truck. A maintenance engineer here at Kirchhoff Automotive, Steve Schaefer, is a man with burly arms making burly parts for burly pickup trucks. The McKinsey analysis puts a job like that at what, Katie?
The person who runs the robots is an industrial engineer. Just 11% of that job is automatable, ironically. The average pay is all right, $81,000 a year, and there are 230,000 of these jobs in the economy.
This Kirchhoff factory has 670 people and is the largest employer in this Michigan county. We're hiring, it says out front. The company works with state and local organizations to get people up to speed on the technology coming onto the assembly line here. Steve himself trains colleagues. He equips people already on the payroll to be indispensable, even as more robots get hired.
We started out with certain types of robots, and now we have 4 different style robots. So it's up to my guys to learn what's new, what's different between this one and that one. How do I troubleshoot that? And how do I fix this? You know, robots may be taking people's jobs, but you still have to have the person to work on that robot and work with that robot.
Because that's a higher level skills if you know how to fix it.
Yes, and most of that is training, you know. It's mechanical, it's electrical, you know. Robots are, people say, well, they're getting smarter every day, but actually they're pretty dumb. They do exactly what people tell them to do.
There's an outfit called Michigan Works Southeast, a program that keeps track of what jobs are growing around here and gives out grants, state money, to get these skills into the hands of locals. Its director tells me the robot-proof jobs in high demand these days have titles like industrial maintenance mechanics, machine builders, prototype technicians. Another dignitary from the local manufacturers association says it's not feasible for companies to just hope people with the right skills will come knocking at the door. They've got to be trained. Programs like this one in Michigan are the gold standard for retraining now. They set up a feedback loop between businesses and trainers. It works best in real time for jobs needed now or pretty soon. Steve Schaefer knows the drill, given all his time in and around auto parts factories.
Quite some time. I've been here for 19 years or almost 19 years and was working at another place for 15 years in the same field, started out as mechanical, went into electrical, and then I went into technical. So about 35, 40 years.
So you've done some retraining yourself.
Oh, yes, every day.
Never ends. Even outside the world of manufacturing, companies are seeing the light on this kind of training from within. The global financial services firm Accenture says it brought in technology that cut 17,000 positions at the firm, but the story doesn't end there. Accenture worked to retrain everyone to do new jobs that the company does need. The net result, Accenture claims, no layoffs from technology and jobs that are less, boring. As for other near future options, wouldn't it be nice if the roaring Silicon Valley job market could also be enjoyed in the land that jobs forgot, say the rustier parts of the Rust Belt or Appalachia? Strangely, it's a politician from California's Silicon Valley pushing just that idea. Here's Ro Khanna, congressman and author of a book called Entrepreneurial Nation, Why Manufacturing is Still Key to America's Future.
I was in Appalachia, Eastern Kentucky, and folks there are being trained on Android software, iOS software for Apple, becoming graphic designers, web designers. So, of course, there's automation that's also displacing things, but what we have to figure out is how do we take advantage of technology and how do communities take advantage of technology?
I have to ask, you represent a California district. What do you care about Kentucky or Appalachia?
Well, one, we need a greater skilled workforce in this country, and the companies that are in my district seek more people with the right training and the right skills. So workforce development is a national issue. And second, we can't, as a country, find common ground if folks are left behind from the technology revolution. If we want to have any chance of healing this country, bringing people together, we have to provide people with a concrete pathway to be productive in this new economy.
The term here, you used it, workforce development, that's about education with a view to creating the skills needed for the jobs that will be out there. Are we doing enough to in this area of workforce development in America?
We're not. And The problem is that some of the skills we're giving folks or training them for are ones that aren't leading to jobs, and that's why people are skeptical. Let me just return to this Paintsville example. Folks there were learning before the new program came how to replace hard drives in computers, and that was not leading to any jobs because that's actually something that could be automated. So there are two things I think that are critical. One is actually getting folks the skills in conjunction with talking to local industry that are going to lead to jobs. And secondly, and this is equally important, for employers to commit to providing jobs and providing an investment in the training.
Getting retraining wrong ought to be a crime. Listen to the story of a man originally from the state of Maine. Robots ate his job and his retraining.
My name's Dana Heath. I was a machinist for 28 years. From 1980 to 2008.
Heath was working up north for a company called Creative Machine.
I was part of the shoe industry. We made aluminum molds for the soles of shoes.
Heath spent his days making these shoe molds, but even in his early years as a machinist, he considered shifting his career, so he started taking classes.
In the 80s, I went back to school for a computer and went to night school for 7 years. Because I thought I was going to get out of the trade and get into something more lucrative. But by the time that 7 years was up, I was far behind in the computers, and I had a bill of about $5,000 for the college. So I really couldn't use what I had learned because I didn't learn it quick enough. And I was getting raises in the machining side of it, so I said, well, I'm making good money. I have a really good health program. I'm going to just forget about trying to go further, and I'll stick with this.
He stuck with it until a new generation of machines came into the factory, computer numerical control, CNC units, where the machines do whatever a computer tells them. Machinists become essentially computer operators.
In 2008, I was let go. It was really through no fault of my own. It was because the way in which the production work is done had changed so much that I was kind of a dinosaur in that industry.
What to do? Heath had already tried retraining for a technical job and ended up with debt and less than cutting-edge skills. If he was going to change his career again, he figured it would have to be a dramatic switch.
And I went back to college to get a degree in social work because the calling that I felt was to do prison ministry. So in the end, everything worked, you know, for a better outcome, really. But at that time, I had no idea what I was going to do when I got let go.
I think the need to get this retraining stuff right is much more pressing now than it was when Dana Heath was making his career decisions. And that may have something to do with robot cars. Now, you may be saying, David, where's the robot car in your robot-proof road trip? Behold. What we have here is the robot version of a Cadillac SRX developed at, yes, Carnegie Mellon University, said to be the birthplace of the autonomous vehicle, in this case, a robot SUV. CMU Electrical and Computer Engineering Professor Raj Rajkumar.
We've been fortunate enough to be able to drive it safely in automated mode across multiple cities.
That's automated mode for 33 miles to Pittsburgh Airport without incident. Another time across Washington, D.C. This caddy looks normal from the outside. Fine Cadillac grille, no freaky electronic headdress or other weird protrusions. Sure, inside there's an explodey-looking red button in the center of the dashboard marked emergency stop. And the infotainment screen switches to radar to spot other cars, pedestrians, and I assume stray wildlife. Well, there's Marketplace producer Katie Long's low-res image on the screen as she dances in front of the car, the stationary car.
Oh, there she is. Okay, look at that.
As luck would have it, the car showed up with a component missing on this day. So for this test, it's hands firmly on the steering wheel in the time-honored tradition. But this encounter did get me thinking, maybe it's the car itself that could be a road trip companion? Professor Rajkumar, serious engineer, will at least entertain my offbeat notion here. He thinks the right metaphor might be Jeeves in the front, humans in the back.
They're sitting in the back seat. They're getting some work done, taking a nap, doing something else while the chauffeur is driving, right? You can imagine the chauffeur actually think of driving Miss Daisy, if you will. They become a companion, a colleague, if you will, right? So you care about them, they care about you. And meanwhile, while they're driving, you get to do whatever you please to do, whatever you choose to do. So that's the future that likely will result when the vehicle is driving itself, except that chauffeur is not physical, is virtual.
The CMU team is hard at work on how autonomous cars will behave in complicated urban settings and dicey special case scenarios. All of this is driven by two things. First, there's a gold rush of capital chasing all this research right now. Think Uber, or think microchip maker Intel spending $15 billion recently to buy a maker of robot car sensors. But Professor Rajkumar is driven by another imperative. 40,000 people died in car and truck crashes last year in the U.S., 1.3 million worldwide, most caused by people making mistakes behind the wheel.
Humans getting distracted, getting mad, getting sleepy, and so on. If instead the vehicle is actually driving itself, most of those fatalities and even more injuries and accidents will actually go down. Not necessarily to zero, but close enough to zero that society will be a big winner.
Robots could radically reduce the carnage, even if there's other collateral damage in the labor market.
Across multiple states in the country, it turns out that driving is the biggest employment sector. So vehicles can drive themselves. I guess there is some fear out there that jobs could be lost. So to me, the good news is that because it's going to take upwards of 10 years before a vehicle can drive itself completely without the help of any human, those jobs are not going to be lost anytime in the near future.
Okay, so 10 years then? Just enough for bus driver Christina Summers.
That's all I ask. Just give me 10. I'll be okay with that.
We met Summers in episode 1 of this podcast. When an algorithm took away her good job, she ended up driving a city bus in Utah, which she hopes doesn't in turn get automated anytime soon. So 10 years, maybe. But it's also true that Mercedes-Benz and one of its German suppliers, Bosch, have just announced a collaboration to put a self-driving taxi on the road in just 4 years. This may be how the robots conquer the labor force, by car. Given the hope that autonomous cars will save tens of thousands of lives every year in America alone, these robots on wheels could become ubiquitous. It's not robots vacuuming rugs at home or picking boxes in an Amazon warehouse that changes society. These cars and trucks remaking our streets and our cities could remake the very nature of not just the labor market, but the entire economy.
Driverless cars is the first big wave that's going to crash over the society. I mean, everyone's going to face this.
That's David Bourne, whom we met earlier at Carnegie Mellon. He's the first ever robotics professor there. And when it comes to tech and jobs, Dr. Bourne's preferred frame is this one.
And this is the real concern. It's not what robots are going to, what jobs robots are going to steal. It's that the people aren't going to be ready to do the jobs that they need to do.
He argues that if we prepare, if, then things do move toward the better and away from the worse. And not just for the people with the high-end degrees that his university gives out.
There's going to be huge demand out there for people that know how to work with jobs, doing the stuff that they're capable of doing. It's not going to be over their head. The jobs are going to be right for people. On the other hand, the nature of the work, the subdivision, what they're used to working, how they're used to working is going to change. And we need to get ready for that. That needs to be a priority.
In the third and final Robot Proof Jobs episode, some radical policy ideas to help America get ready for the technology-driven workplace. I've come across some revolutionary proposals that could mean rewiring the entire U.S. economy. In the next and final part of our podcast series, what if we owned all these robots?